Welcome to the last day of the last of Mark's lectures. Later on, we will have Peter Liu on topological phases of matter and quantum computation. But so it seems that some people are still missing, maybe slowed down by the snow. But we start anyway. Otherwise, we risk to go too late. If you have any questions, we can start from there. Otherwise, feel free to ask them. I don't see you very well. Otherwise, Mark.
Thanks.
Can start.
Okay, yeah, if you have questions, we can start with that. Otherwise, so I think what we should do now, reasonably, is give some examples of this Noether second theorem to see the structure that we mentioned yesterday, whether it's happening or not. Of course, it's happening, but to see exactly what these terms look like. So the first example, so we'll do Maxwell and gravity. So we can start with Maxwell. So we'll take we just start from the Lagrangian, and we take -1/4 for convenience, f mu nu. Then we vary the Lagrangian, so becomes -1/2 f mu nu delta f mu nu. So this is just minus d mu delta a nu. So that's just what we would do, right, to get the equations of motion. So integrate by parts, and we get d mu f mu nu delta a nu minus d mu f mu nu delta a nu. Right. So we have the symplectic potential of Maxwell theory here, and here we have we recognize the Maxwell equations enforced by the variation of the field. So now what we can check is already the first, the second Noether identity. So the second Noether identity was to, so again, this is just, this is what we called E delta phi plus d mu theta mu. So let's look at this E delta phi piece and see whether it satisfies, or see how it satisfies this second Noether, this Noether identity, which gives us the second theorem. So we take, here E delta phi. So for a gauge transformation, so delta alpha a mu, this is d mu alpha. Okay, so this is partial mu f mu nu, okay, delta alpha a nu, so this is partial mu f mu nu d nu alpha. And then we integrate this by parts to isolate alpha. Right? This is how we motivated yesterday, that if we do several integration by parts, it isolates a boundary term which we called C, and we can factor out alpha, and then the bulk piece has to vanish if the transformation is a symmetry. Of course, we already know that delta alpha acting on L gives identically zero. We know that it's a symmetry. So the bulk piece that we will get has to vanish. And so what is this bulk piece? So I integrate this by parts, minus d nu, d mu f mu nu alpha, plus the boundary term, d mu f mu nu alpha. And so, as expected, we see that the bulk piece vanishes. It vanishes because f mu nu is anti-symmetric, and we have these two partial derivatives. So that's the Noether identity for U1 gauge theory, for Maxwell theory. So this is just identically zero. Zero plus this piece, this is what we call C, up to a sign. We can get this sign because I can trade the object, we called it C mu, so I can relabel mu and nu, so this is minus partial mu f mu nu alpha. So this is our C. This is what we called C yesterday. Okay, so it has it's exactly what we said yesterday, that the second theorem would give us. So the bulk piece is vanishing, and we only have a boundary term. Now we can compute the neutral current. So now we have delta alpha on L. This is immediately vanishing. And so the neutral current So neutral current is the symplectic potential evaluated under variation. So it's theta evaluated on the variation minus the possible boundary term that you would get from varying the Lagrangian, which here is zero. So minus zero. And so the symplectic potential theta, it's minus f mu nu delta I nu. Okay. So this is minus f mu nu. Sorry, this is a current, right? This is an index, of course. So minus f mu nu delta, so again, evaluated on a gauge transformation, so delta alpha I nu. Okay, and this is minus f mu nu partial nu, partial nu alpha. And then we can, again, integrate this by parts. And if we integrate this by parts, it will take exactly the form for the currents that we mentioned yesterday at the end of the lecture, namely that there is a bulk piece. Well, not really bulk, because this is already one dimension lower, right? So like a three-dimensional bulk piece and a two-dimensional boundary term. And the three-dimensional bulk piece is given by C. And the two-dimensional boundary term is the divergence of something antisymmetric, which is what we call the Wald-Noether charge Q. So we integrate by parts, and we get d nu f mu nu alpha minus d nu f mu nu alpha. And what we said yesterday is that the structure of this was C mu plus d nu q, right? This is the form of the current that we wrote yesterday at the end of the lecture. And indeed, it has this form, right? We recognize exactly C. So we identified C with the sign convention that we chose yesterday. We identified C from this piece, which corresponds to the equations of motion. So we have C. And when we write the current and integrate it by parts, we get again C here, and we get this antisymmetric object here, which is the Wald-Noether charge. Okay? So it has the structure expected from Noether 2. And now, for example, we can look at one particular case of this surface charge, which is here. So for alpha equals 1, the integral of this over a 2 surface will give you the electric charge. Right? So the electric charge, QE, will be the integral of this. So if the surface is, the reason for which, in a sense, this has 2 indices is that this has to be smeared now against a codimension 2 object. So here in 4 dimensions, a 2-dimensional surface. This 2-dimensional surface has 2 normals. The natural thing to do is to pick, for example, if you are in Minkowski spacetime, a surface at constant time and constant radius. So we would pick the 0R component of the field strength, and that's the electric field. Right? So this is D to x. Yes, there is also this convenient minus sign here, so we would get minus f 0r, which with the conventions we had, with a mostly minus, mostly plus signature, this is just the radial electric field. And now this electric charge is conserved, because if we now hit this with the time derivative, we can use now Maxwell's equation to show that this is conserved on shell. So dQE by dt, this is d2x, let's put the minus sign again, dtf0r. But the Maxwell equation tells us, so the radial component of the Maxwell equation is just this, divergence of f. So if we take the radial part of the Maxwell equation, we get dt of f0r plus dA of far equals 0. So I can trade this here on shell for dA of far. And now this A index refers to indices on the two-dimensional sphere upon which I'm integrating. So by Stokes' theorem, this is just integral on the sphere of this divergence, so this is 0. Okay, so this is the Maxwell illustration of this second theorem. We will, in fact, rederive this a bit later with just different methods. Immediately when we see, just in the next section, the next chapter will be the so-called covariant phase space method. And once we understand this, we can rederive this result. And we will do it just using differential forms. So it's now you have the proof with all the indices. We can do it later with differential forms, just to manipulate them and to recover the same result. So now it's also very interesting to, yes?
So in the last column, you set alpha equal to 1. Mm-hmm. So it's just 1 among many.
Yes.
And this is special. Now, what I think what I wanted to point out is that this one is special.
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, if I don't set alpha equals to 1, you see I will have to, I could still integrate this. But when I take the time derivative, I will hit on this. Usually, people are, so alpha equals constant would be the true field symmetry, where the variation of the gauge field is actually identically 0. So let's see how, I'm wondering whether I should put, so if you're okay, if we write all the details, we can do the GR case and see that we will recover some structure that we saw previously. So for GR, we have to, the one thing which we have not been very specific about is the structure of the symplectic potential for gravity. So for this, we can start from the Lagrangian again. For generality, we can even put a cosmological constant. We will see that the corresponding Noether identity completely accommodates this. And now if you just recall the variation of this, so we first have the variation of the volume element. So I don't know if I should put the minus, which convention I should put. I should vary. Yeah, let me put a minus sign so I vary the G upstairs. This will be simpler maybe. So we get this, r minus 2 lambda. And then we get the variation of r. But now the variation of r is just, so r is a g mu nu r mu nu, the trace of r in g. This is delta g mu nu r mu nu plus g mu nu delta r mu nu. And now the point is that, I mean, you may know this from the Einstein-Hilbert variational principle. You notice that these two contributions already give the Einstein equations. Right here we have set up to the global factor of square root g. So we have square root g delta g mu nu r mu nu minus 1/2 r g mu nu plus lambda. So we have already the Einstein equations. So this means that, well, this piece which we have left out, this is a boundary term, in fact. So plus square root g, g mu nu, delta r mu nu. So this, in fact, is already of the form E. This is E delta phi, so the field equations, or E, if you want, E, E mu nu delta g mu nu, plus, this is some d mu of theta mu, the symplectic potential. And now this symplectic potential, we can, so usually we, for the variational principle, we discard it because we already have the equations of motion here. We just argue that this is a boundary term. If you want to, for example, study the variational principle, study how to impose Dirichlet boundary conditions. So you may know that in 4D gravity, this the variational principle for Einstein-Hilbert alone is already a Neumann-type variational principle. If you want to switch this to Dirichlet, you have to use a surface term. You can read this from the structure of this boundary term, which is precisely the symplectic potential. So now let's write the symplectic potential. So to find it, one has to actually compute the variation of the Ricci tensor and use some variational identities for the Ricci tensor. And you will find that this object is g alpha beta, and there's a variation of the Christoffel symbol, and then alpha mu delta beta. There's a sum here, beta, beta, alpha. So that's the symplectic potential for Einstein-Hilbert gravity. And again, you see, it's important for later that I write this really in field theory form. So I put the square root of g in the definition of theta, and here I just have a partial derivative, instead of keeping square root g here and a covariant derivative. And now just for later, there is actually, because we will manipulate this, we, a convenient way to rewrite it is actually in terms of variations of the metric and not variations of the Christoffel. And to do that, you can, well, there is a formula for the variation of the Christoffel. In fact, it's the same formula as really the, as in fact the definition of the Christoffel, but you put covariant derivatives here and variations of delta sigma plus mu minus sigma delta g mu nu. And using this, you can rewrite that in the form. So now it's important that I don't drop any. That I don't drop the sign. Yes, so this is. Yes. G mu nu. G alpha beta delta G alpha beta minus delta g nu nu. So that's the form of the potential, which is useful for the computation that we will do now. So it has indeed on the right, yeah, free mu index. It's okay. Okay, so now the first thing we can do is evaluate the, so I leave this here. First thing we can do is compute the neuter identity. And so the neuter identity comes again from taking this piece that has the equations of motion and putting a symmetry transformation here. So the symmetry transformation here, now for us it's delta. The parameter is a vector field because we look at the diffeomorphism. So this acts with the Lie derivative. So we'll take this and just replace delta g mu nu by the Lie derivative of g mu nu. So we have, so E on phi, this term. So this for us is square root g, Lie derivative along psi of g mu nu, and the Einstein equation, g mu nu plus lambda. Oh, sorry, I forgot g mu nu here. Plus lambda g mu nu. Okay, but now the Lie derivative on g with upstairs indices, that's minus, get also a factor of 2 because this is symmetric, so minus 2 nabla mu xi nu g mu nu plus lambda g mu nu. And now again, we do the same thing as we did for Maxwell or as we did, we argued for generally yesterday. We just integrate this by parts. And so we get plus 2 square root g, sorry, now it's xi alone, nabla mu, g mu nu plus lambda g mu nu. And then the boundary term minus 2 partial mu, sorry, partial mu square root g, xi nu, g mu nu plus lambda g mu nu. And again, we see now that we have isolated the boundary term, a bulk piece which has the symmetry parameter without any derivative acting on it. And what we obtain by doing this is the Bianchi identity here, divergence of g. So this is, as expected, identically zero. This term is zero because of the Bianchi identity. And this term is zero because the metric is preserved by the covariant derivative. So this piece, this is zero. So again, it has the form zero minus a boundary term, which we use to identify this piece C. So we see here that, again, this idea that if there is a gauge symmetry, the only possibility for the Lagrangian to be invariant under gauge symmetry, the reason why this is a possibility is that the equations of motion, they satisfy certain relationships between them. And in the case of diffeomorphism symmetry, the relationship satisfied by the equations of motion is the Bianchi identity. And here the cosmological constant term also plays along because nabla g is zero. So now what we have to do is evaluate the neuter current and see that it has again the form that we expect. Okay, so we have to evaluate the current again. So now J mu. So again, the current has two pieces. There's the potential evaluated on the symmetry, the Lie derivative, minus the boundary term that we get from varying the Lagrangian now. And so because it's a diffeomorphism symmetry, when we vary the Lagrangian L, this is, it gives this. Right, this we derived, I think, 2 days ago. We explained why we have this. So minus this B term, xi mu L. So let's just compute the two pieces separately. In fact, this piece, there's nothing to compute. We know what it is. This requires some calculation. So I go back here, and now I evaluate theta on the Lie derivative. Right, so evaluating on the Lie derivative, again, remember that lead derivative of G mu nu upstairs is minus the symmetrization of nabla xi. So with this minus sign, I swap what's inside of the parenthesis here. So delta G mu nu, this gives nabla mu xi nu plus nabla nu xi mu. And this is the GAB delta GAB, so I get twice the same term here. So minus G mu nu and just, sorry, 2 okay. Now I just bring this covariant derivative inside, and we will see what we can do then. Mu xi nu plus nabla nu xi mu minus 2 nabla nu nabla alpha xi alpha. And in fact, here, so we just skip one or two steps that are detailed in the notes, just to tell you how this happens. In fact, if you look at this term and this term, up to a factor 2, so if I put a factor 2 here and I subtract, so I add this term and I subtract it again, then I have twice this, minus 2 times this, and this is a commutator of covariant derivatives contracted with xi. Here it's the first one contracted with xi, here it's the second one. So this commutator of covariant derivatives with this construction of xi, this gives the Ricci tensor. So here there's twice the Ricci tensor which appears, provided I add and subtract this term. So at the end of the day, what appears here is 2 times the Ricci, and then plus nabla nu, nabla nu xi mu minus nabla mu xi nu. Okay. So conveniently, this becomes the Ricci tensor contracted to this xi, and this becomes again a surface term. There is again a boundary term appearing in J itself, signaling, as we expect, that J will take the form that we know from the second theorem now, C plus the divergence of something. And the something is here, and you recognize already the Komar aspect. The Komar quantity that we introduced is appearing here. Yeah, so now we put this with that over there, and you will see that this Ricci tensor, together with this contribution from the Lagrangian, this will combine to give actually the Einstein equation. And so this is the bulk piece C, which we know has to vanish on shell. And it vanishes on shell because the Einstein equations appear here. So if we now put this together, I combine this and that, you combine that and you get 2 square root G xi nu G mu nu plus lambda G mu nu, the Einstein equation, plus d nu of q mu nu. So on shell, this is just d nu of q mu nu, and this q mu nu, which appears, maybe there's a sign, no, like this. So this is square root g nabla mu xi nu minus nabla mu xi nu. Yes? No, because this is a density, it's not a scalar, right? So remember, to prove this, we use the fact that on any object of this form, where F is a scalar now, on any object of this form, this is 1/2 square root G mu nu delta G mu nu F plus square root G delta F. Now you replace this delta by the lead derivative, Here you have nabla xi, and here you have the derivative of a scalar. So here you have the directional derivative. But these two things combine in such a way that this comes out. Okay, yeah, so that's the proof that we, this structure predicted by the second theorem is true for general relativity. We do this bit of calculation and we see again that the Noether current is the bulk piece C. So again, and the C is up to the factor of 2 and to the sign, up to everything is exactly the C which appears here from the contribution of the equations of motion. So this gives C, C is vanishing on shell, C appears in the Noether current, it's here, it vanishes on shell, and the only thing we're left with is this boundary term. And from this boundary term, we identify again, we recognize here the Komar, the Komar quantity. So up to the fact that I think when we defined Komar before, there was no square root of G inside because we were discussing the conservation of these currents in terms of covariant derivative, so covariant conservation. But the covariant conservation of the current is the same up to a factor of square root G, this one, as the conservation in the partial derivative, right? And here everywhere I have put partial derivatives just to have this kind of generic field theory notation. So that's why there is a square root of G here. No. Yes, there was a minus part, yes. Okay, so that's it for the kind of the illustration of the second theorem on these two examples. So now I think, maybe now we can move to the last part or second to last part. So I wanted to mention a bit, again, this will reappear in a minute. So we will see where this plays a role. But now I wanted to discuss a bit something a bit more advanced, but very important that many people use these days, which is, you will see, it's kind of a mathematical formalism, a framework to actually manipulate these surface charges and derive them, construct these surface charges. It's a prescription for how to obtain surface charges. We will see where the Komar charge appears. We will see where the electric charge appears when we apply this to Maxwell. And so this formalism, I think it's section 4. Yes. So 4. This is called the covariant phase space. Formalism. So essentially, this covariant phase space formalism, there are extremely mathematically rigorous ways to introduce this. I just want to, again, this is just very superficial. I just want to give you an intuition and an idea for what this structure is and how it works, and how there is, to give you a flavor of why there is an almost algorithmic way, almost systematic way, up to certain ambiguities which we can mention, to actually obtain surface charges like this and manipulate them, compute Poisson brackets between them and ask more refined physical questions that we will see in a minute. So in this covariant phase space, it relies in fact on the underlying mathematical structure of this is something a bit fancy called the variational bicomplex. So we can forget about this term, but just to mention that, so there's two important things here. One is variational and the other one is bicomplex. So bi, so there's like some two types of structures and variational that enable us to do variational calculus. And why these two types of structure? Because essentially this covariant phase space is just making very formal and acknowledging the fact that here we have this, in fact, what we did since the beginning without explicitly worrying about this or mentioning it is to manipulate these variations here. And these variations on a specific space, namely the space of fields, right? These variations were acting on some quantities which implicitly we, in the back of our heads, we were thinking of as living in some space of fields, right? There are things which we vary. There is no here auxiliary structure which we didn't vary, but it could happen that, well, in fact, there was, sorry, because, for example, these symmetry parameters, in fact, explicitly yesterday we said that these symmetry parameters, we chose them to not depend on the fields. So that's why yesterday when we varied, for example, the Gauss constraint, when we computed this, the variation of the Gauss constraint with gauge parameter alpha, the variation went through alpha, in fact, because we were not thinking of alpha as depending on the fields. So alpha was not, in a sense, acted on by this derivative, by this variation. So this covariant phase space method uses the fact that we have to be very mindful of the fact that now there are these variations here, and we can ask mathematically how to actually manipulate these variations. And it turns out that the manipulation of these variations can be made in a way very analogous to the manipulation of differential forms and exterior calculus. So manipulating differential forms and especially the exterior derivative. So I just want to list very few ingredients and properties that we will need for that. So essentially the idea is that you have space-time, right? And on space-time you have differential calculus. You have differential forms on space-time. So you have two things, space-time, and on space-time you have differential forms like this, for example. And you can take a derivative like this on space-time. And essentially the idea is to think that in addition to space-time, there is also the space of fields. And on the space of fields, there is also what plays the role of D, in a sense, is this variation that we have manipulated. And just like, for example, D in differential forms, D squares to zero, this variation delta also squares to zero. Let me just denote this by, earlier the generic fields, we called them phi like this. So a variation in the space of fields, you can think of this as being delta phi. So whenever you have an object which is expanded on a basis of dx, you think of this as a differential form that has a certain form degree. In the same way, you can think of an object like this, delta phi, a variation of the field, as being a one form, but not a one form on space-time, but one form on the space of fields. Okay. So in a sense, this means that all the objects that we have manipulated here, in a sense, they have, if you work with differential forms, if you acknowledge the fact that there are these variations here, all these objects, they have, you can think of them as having two types of form degrees. They have a form degree on space-time. They also have a form degree on the space of fields, in fact. So for example, the Lagrangian, for example, L is so it's a form. But from the point of view of space-time, the Lagrangian L is a four form. If you are in four space-time dimensions, right? This is a four form, and intuitively, you just think that in the Lagrangian, there is, for the moment, we have not done this operation of taking field variations. In the Lagrangian, there is no variation of the fields. So from this space of fields perspective, the Lagrangian is a zero form. So it's a 4, 0 form. On the other hand, theta, the symplectic potential, well, theta was obtained, again, as the boundary term that we get when we, now when we vary the Lagrangian. So if we had written everything in differential forms from the beginning, as we will do in a minute, so we already mentioned that theta is a codimension one object. So in terms of forms, it's a lower dimensional object. So it's a three form, in fact. It's not a four form. In fact, everything we have done here is manipulate theta with a vector index upstairs like this. So this is just the three form dualized to a vector with one index. So this is a three form in space-time. But now theta contains a variation inside. Right? This is why also many times explicitly I have written theta of delta to remember the fact that theta is a variational object. So it's a certain differential form on space-time. It's a three form, but it is more than that. It's also a variational object. And it has only one variation. So it's a 3, 1 form. And we will see in a minute how to naturally build, for example, a 3, 2 form, so a 2 form in field space. And how we will do that? Well, just like you increase the form degree on space-time by taking derivatives like this, you can increase the form degree on the space of fields by taking variations like this. And again, you have to remember that whenever you take variations, you have to anti-symmetrize the variations, which is why delta square squares to zero. So let's just, it's a bit formal still, let's just manipulate this and see what we can do with that. The only other thing we need, the only other piece of notation is, you know that also when we do differential calculus on space-time, there is an interior product. We can contract vector fields and forms. In fact, the point of doing this is that you can think that there is a similar structure on the space of fields. You can contract vector fields and forms. Well, these forms, what are they? They are these such variations of the fields, for example, a one form. And the vector fields, what are they? Well, you can think of the vector fields as all these types of variations of the fields that we have considered. Whenever you have a field configuration, you do a little infinitesimal gauge transformation. You can think of this as a vector field in the space of fields. And now you can take this vector field in the space of fields and contract them with these differential forms in the space of fields. And in terms of notation, this just means the following. So the next piece of notation that I need is, so here, there is this. Here there is an interior product which, so here we will, I should also mention, of course, that Aldo is really the in-house expert on this formalism. He has worked a lot on this and also contributed to making this very rigorous. So maybe you have also taken the Psi lectures with Aldo and you've already seen some of this. And of course, people sometimes disagree on notations and things, so I will maybe disagree now with a notation for the interior product. So sometimes, usually the interior product is denoted by I like this. Sometimes it's also denoted by a little hook like this. For some reason, I like the hook a bit better. Then the interior product on the space of fields, just to differentiate, is denoted by capital I. And sometimes I denote it with some people denote it with a double hook like this. Let's just see what this means, in fact, concretely. It's just the interior product between a vector field and a differential form is what, so between, for example, between a vector field, and imagine you have a form omega, which is, well, maybe not omega, p, which is p mu dx mu. Right? The contraction between the vector field and the form, that's what we denote with the interior product, right? That's just psi mu, p mu, right? So if we denote psi p, so in notation, this is the, if you use this I notation, this interior product notation, usually you denote this I sub psi acting on p. This is just that, right? So now just there is just have to realize that there is a similar structure on the space of fields here. And so we just want here a bookkeeping device, a notation that enables us to, whenever we have a variational form, so an object which contains variations of the fields, we want at some point to do, well, a bit explicitly what we did here, but without giving a name to it or without giving a mathematical machinery behind this. Namely, which is to just evaluate this on a specific field variation, which means, in fact, contracting this differential form in field space, this variational differential form, with a vector field. And the vector field is the symmetry transformation. So between, so now which, yeah, which notation should I choose? So to be very rigorous, I should just mention this notation, for example. Yes, d for x. Let me just explain what I mean by this. Delta. Let's call it delta phi x. So rigorously speaking, if I have a field somewhere, for example, I have the metric or a gauge field or anything like that. If I want to act with a gauge transformation on this gauge field, the proper way to mathematically define this vector field on field space, which produces this gauge transformation for me, would be to use this functional derivative here, and then integrate. And this is involving here the field transformation in which we're interested. So this would be the proper way to define the vector field generating this transformation. But just for shorthand notation, so it's just a notation here. I just want to insist that, I mean, some people might disagree, but I think that as long as we are okay with the type of objects that we're manipulating, we can a bit decide on our notations, and which here doesn't make any sense because we have not manipulated this, so I cannot ask you to believe all of this, but hopefully we do examples right after and you see what this structure is useful for. So let's just decide on some notation to be able to do that. And the notation would be the following. Would be, so again, by analogy, we want to take the interior product between a vector field and a differential form in field space, which is a variation. And the proper way to denote this would be that, for example. Well, if we did that, what would this mean by complete analogy with this, if you want, would be that I will take the form direction in here, the variation delta, and replace this with the gauge transformation, which is here. This is what this operation is doing, this interior product in the space of fields. And so this returns for me theta evaluated on delta epsilon. And just like the interior product on spacetime decreases the form degree, right? If you contract a P form with a vector field, you get a P minus one form, right? D increases the form degree, and the interior product decreases the form degree. Here it's the same thing on field space. The variation increases the form degree, and this interior product decreases the form degree. And it decreases it, why? Because here, you see, if I contract this with theta, here I have a variation in theta, so from this field space perspective, there is a one-form entry in field space. But as soon as I take this interior product, this operation is to replace this variation by something very specific, a very specific field configuration. So the variation has disappeared now, right? I have replaced the variation by a Lie derivative. So this is kind of making more formal and more explicit the fact that when we did these calculations, every once in a while, the objects that we were manipulating were changing status a little bit. At some point, some of these objects were true variational forms. And at some point, we replaced the variation by an actual explicit gauge transformation. And then these objects are not variational forms anymore. And so this, for a shortcut, just not to have to write down this x here. So for shortcut, we can just denote this I epsilon with theta, or just with this notation here, this double hook, epsilon theta. Right. So now the notation is just that we should see and remember that if there is a hook like this, it means that the contraction has to be between space-time indices, between a vector field and a form. And if there is a double hook like this, what this means is that I have to contract the infinitesimal gauge transformation generated by this, replace this in the form entries which are here. Okay. So let's manipulate this just a bit and see what this, so what's the point of doing that? What we can do with that? So the point of doing that, of introducing this notation, so at the end of the day, that's what matters here, right? Is why introduce this notation? Why keep track of all these details? What does it buy for us? So the reason to keep track of these details is that now we can talk about the potential and the symplectic structure. So how should we think of that? So the potential is, again, the object which we identify from the variation of the Lagrangian. But now, it's completely analogous to what we did before. I just changed notations now. I'm thinking that I'm using differential forms. So the d4x is included in what I call L, the Lagrangian now. This is a four form. And the manipulations that we did, essentially, they amount to doing this. Integrate by parts to isolate the equations of motion. And then the boundary term, written in terms of forms, is just the exterior derivative of a three form now. Right? So the Lagrangian is a four form. There is a variation here, d of a three form. So theta. And now it's manifest from what we said here that this structure is completely respected, right? Lagrangian is a four form, and it has no variation. So it's a zero form in field space, so a four zero form. Then as soon as I take the variation of the Lagrangian, now I have a one form in field space on the left and on the right. And now I have d of theta, right? So this makes it explicit that theta is a 3, 3, 1 form. So that's the potential. Now we can talk about the symplectic current. So the symplectic current, we call it omega. And omega, in fact, is obtained by taking a further variation of the symplectic potential. So omega is just the variation of theta. So again, it's a three form in space-time because it has the same form degree as theta, but I have taken another variation of this. So in field space, the form degree has increased. So it's a 3, 2 form. So sometimes if you read the notes on this or text, or I'm not sure it disappears in many textbooks, but if you read about this in other places, again, people use a different bunch of notation. Sometimes to kind of explicitly keep track of this, they use a notation which can be a bit confusing. They write explicitly, just like we did here, we wrote theta with sometimes explicitly the delta. So remember that there is a variation sitting in there, but it's a one form in field space. Sometimes people write omega like this, for example. You could keep track explicitly of the fact that there are two variations, just so that you don't forget when you do calculations later. Yet another notation that people use sometimes is the following one, is to write omega as delta 1 theta delta 2 minus delta 2 theta delta 1. But we will just keep omega like this and just remember that omega is the variation of the symplectic potential. Now, sorry, there are just some other rules which I should have written here, is that, well, usually on space-time, we also write explicitly. Again, it depends on which, where you look at, which authors does that. Sometimes we keep track of the wedge product between the differential forms, and then remember that the wedge product satisfies also certain rules when we permute the differential forms. So we have, we can write P wedge Q, for example, for a P form and a Q form. And then we know that this is minus one PQ, so the form degree P and Q of Q wedge P. So you have this for forms on space-time. But in fact, again, the exact same thing is holds. The same, there are similar properties for forms on field space now. Especially for theta, it's not a problem because theta is a one form in field space. So theta is as if you had just P or Q. There is nothing to really worry about. The question is what happens when you have now a two form in field space? Because two form means that inside there are two variations. So what happens if you swap these variations? Well, the same kind of same thing happens. If you have delta P wedge delta Q. So this is a one form in field space. So again, this is a P form in space-time, a Q form in space-time. So if I want to swap this, I pick up this sign because of the space-time properties of these differential forms. But this is a one form in field space. This is a one form in field space. So when I swap this, I also pick a, for the same reason, I pick a minus sign from swapping these variations in field space. So this is minus, minus one PQ delta Q wedge delta P. Again, we'll just see explicitly below why it might not be obvious why this is useful for the moment, but we'll see an example in a minute. And also see why these rules are very important to remember, because in fact, these rules are just here to make the whole formalism consistent, in fact. If these rules were not satisfied, then we would have kind of all these calculational rules here, they sit nicely nicely together. Okay, so maybe let's do an example because it's not, yeah, so the last thing we need, so we have the potential, we have the symplectic current. The last thing we need is the symplectic structure. The symplectic structure is just, in fact, the integral of the symplectic current over a three-dimensional slice. So you take a, so again, omega is a three form. So you can naturally integrate omega over a three-dimensional hypersurface. If you integrate omega over a three-dimensional hypersurface like this, you get a zero form in space-time. But it's still a two form in field space, right? So meaning that, see here I have done nothing to the field variations. So there were two field variations in here. There are still two field variations in here. So it's still a two form in field space. So now comes the point. What's the point of having this object and of having these rules here? Just think of these as rules. What's the point of having this? The point is that now the generator of a gauge transformation is, so now the point of this is that it enables us to, well, usually that's what mathematical objects do, right? They enable you to, you ask a question and it gives an answer. Here it does exactly that. But what is the type of question you can ask? The question is a bit, let me start from the end. The question is a bit opposite to what we did yesterday in the, or what you do in the Hamiltonian formalism. In the Hamiltonian formalism, you can start with a complicated theory in which, for example, you don't know what the gauge symmetries are. Then you do the Hamiltonian analysis. You go through this algorithm that Dirac spelled out, so the analysis of the constraints. And then at the end of this algorithm, if you manage to identify the first class constraints, it's what we argued for yesterday, the first class constraints, they generate gauge transformations. So once you know the first class constraints, by Poisson bracket, you know what they generate. Here, the type of question is a bit the other way around. Here it's, if you know the gauge transformation, how it's acting, which is what we did since now, right? Here we everywhere we already knew that U1 gauge transformations, delta alpha, act the way they do. We knew that diffeomorphisms act the way they do by Lie derivative. So if you know that, if you know how the symmetry, the gauge symmetry is acting, then what this can do for you is spit out, tell you what is the generator, the Hamiltonian generator of these gauge transformations. So think of this as being a bit opposite to the kind of more conventional Hamiltonian analysis. So why, how this works? How to get the generator of the gauge transformation from this structure? Well, to get it, you get it in the following way. Let me call it G epsilon again. To get that, I explain the notation in a minute. I put a minus sign, and I just use this contraction now. So now we have, if you introduce this, we have to use at some point these new things which we can do, these new manipulations. So let's do that now. Let's take epsilon and contract it with the symplectic structure, right? And now it should be clear, just again, if we agree from the onset on our notation, it should be clear what this means, right? If I put a double hook like this, it means that now I'm doing something on the level of the field space. I'm doing something with the variations of the fields and the tangent vectors on field space, so the gauge transformations of the fields. And what I'm doing is that I'm taking the variations in here, so the two form in field space, these deltas which are in here, and I'm replacing them by a gauge transformation with parameter epsilon. And again, following these rules of calculus on the field space, this is a two form in field space. When I contract it with a tangent vector, I get a one form in field space because this operation decreases the form degree. So I start from a two form, I contract in field space, I get, with a tangent vector, I get a one form. So this is a variational one form. So there should be a delta hiding somewhere in here. So to be precise, let's use this notation, delta slash, in fact. You will see why delta slash in a minute, because this is to remember that there is a delta here. This is still a one form in field space, but this object might not be delta exact, in fact. When you compute this here, see, it's not guaranteed that what you compute here will be the delta of something. It can be a complicated field-dependent object with a delta embedded somewhere inside, and then you cannot pull the delta because you're hitting everywhere on the fields. So there is a delta, but the delta is maybe not, this thing might not be delta exact. So that's the structure. So in fact, why it has this structure? Why is this the case, in fact, that this is happening? So the reason for this, is the following. So to prove it, let me just simplify this even further and write something very schematic. So I'm being extremely schematic now. I drop the integral, just structurally what happens. Structurally what happens is the following thing. Omega is the, okay, so let's keep the integral. Okay, it's the integral of delta omega, delta theta. But theta, the symplectic potential, at the end of the day, theta, you can think of this as being p delta q, right? In mechanics, this would just be p delta q. So what is omega? Omega is delta p delta q, right? Again, with the rule that delta p delta q. With the rule that if I want to write this delta q delta p, I pick up a minus sign because I'm swapping these field space variations here. So omega is delta p delta q. So this is the integral of delta p delta q. So now what is this operation? Taking this with a minus sign, taking this contraction here. Well, this thing, omega, this means that, again, I have to follow the same rules as I would follow for a contraction of a vector field in space-time. If you contract a vector field on a differential form in space-time, you have to hit all the form entries of the differential form. So here we do the same thing. So this is, so there is minus sign, so minus epsilon contracted with delta P, delta Q. Okay. But epsilon, let me write it here, the other rule, epsilon contracted with delta P, delta Q. Right, so this is, first I'm contracting delta with this variation, sorry, epsilon with this variation. So this is delta epsilon P, delta Q. Now again, it's just like for differential forms in spacetime. Now if I want to contract here, I go through this variation here, so I pick up a minus sign. If the vector field goes through a P form in field space, you pick up minus one to the power P, where P is the form degree. You pick up a sign. So here we pick up a sign, delta epsilon Q. You see that all these sign rules are completely consistent with each other. So that's what we mean by the contraction of epsilon with delta P delta Q, which returns this, and indeed, as expected, this is a variational one form now. Because now the variation of P and Q here has disappeared, but I still have one variation. So, okay, this is to say that if I just keep track of this minus sign here, with the minus sign, this is now delta epsilon Q delta P minus delta epsilon P delta Q. This is what we get. But now you see that by construction, this object, if now you call this delta slash G, sorry, epsilon, well now by construction, this is the object such that by Poisson bracket now, when you act with this by Poisson bracket on Q or P, it returns delta epsilon Q or delta epsilon P, which is the gauge transformation of Q or the gauge transformation of P, right? So you start from the gauge transformation, which you know. You feed the gauge transformation to the symplectic structure. It gives you an object. The object is the generator of this gauge transformation. And that's the case because if we compute the action of G on Q, right? Wait, the action of G by Poisson bracket on Q, that's just the functional derivative of G with respect to P, which gives delta epsilon of Q. Okay? So it gives exactly the gauge transformation of Q. So that's the reason why we want to consider this object, in fact, is because it enables us to do these manipulations. Let's see, maybe very 14. Sorry?
So that means if this expression is true, where like when we have this, you evaluated epsilon in our product with del P del Q, there you're just taking a minus of that, right?
Sorry, which formula? This one?
The last line. The last line.
Yes.
That. So I think I agree with that.
Yeah.
And the, on the right hand side, you're taking just an overall minus of that, right?
Yes. So I put the minus, right?
But then the first term should have del P first.
No, no, but in fact, when I wrote it, I thought about saying it, but then I thought I should have said it. Now it doesn't matter anymore, right? Because once in this term here, this term, now it's just a variational one form. This thing here is not a form in field space anymore.
Okay, okay, okay.
This thing is not a form in field space. So if I swap these two, it doesn't matter. Up to, of course, the fact that here I didn't put a wedge product because I'm kind of pretending here that P and Q are zero form in that time in mechanics, for example. If I was in mechanics, there would be no integral here. So it's true that rigorously there is, three dimensions here. So these are also forms. So there is a wedge product here. So whenever I move objects around, I have to be very careful about the, but I just follow these rules, right? The rules of commuting forms in space-time and the rules of moving around forms in field space. In fact, we can do maybe very quickly the example of Maxwell theory to see how this works again. So,
Mark, maybe one last point. In the last line, he is well defined as a function on field space only when the delta slash is an actual.
Yes, thanks. Yes, so indeed, I rubbed a bit under the carpet here the fact that from the beginning I was keeping this delta slash, and I said it's not clear whether we can actually do that. Well, indeed, as Aldo is pointing out, it's very important to be able to compute this, that G is actually delta exact. So if this, okay, here I'm not putting more structure here, but let's imagine that this does not depend on the fields anymore. Imagine that this is delta exact. Right? Imagine that you have this. If you have this, you have that. So you see that already from this, it gives us a bit some extra structure, which was not very manifest from what we did yesterday, for example. This is telling us that, well, even if you know the symplectic structure, you know the gauge transformation, it's not actually very clear that you can really recover a function on phase space, which is the Hamiltonian vector field for this transformation. It's not really guaranteed that this exists. And this is the question of whether this is actually delta exact. So in some cases it is, in some cases, as we will see in a minute, it's actually not, so we have to be really careful about that. Let's do very quickly Maxwell theory, just to see exactly what this structure gives us, and then I was hoping to move on to GR, and we can maybe finish with the GR formula. So for Maxwell, so the Lagrangian written in forms is what? It's star F wedge F, right? That's the Maxwell Lagrangian as a four form. Let me put just a minus 1/2 here. Okay, delta L is star F wedge delta F. So star F wedge D delta A. Again, this is the exact same structure as compare this to the equations we had before. It's the same thing written in differential forms. Star F delta A. And now I integrate this by parts to isolate the potential. So D star F wedge delta A plus, so minus plus D. And again, that's the bulk piece, delta A enforcing the Maxwell equations, written here in differential forms. And now that's theta, that's the symplectic potential. So now let's follow this machinery. Let's start with theta, compute these things, and see if it gives what we said it would give, namely the generator of the gauge transformations. Let's see that. So theta is star F wedge delta A. So omega, I take a further variation of this. Omega is delta theta, so it's delta of star F wedge delta A. Now omega is the integral over sigma of this. And now if I know omega, I can ask the question, well, what is the generator of the U1 gauge transformations? For this, I take the U1 gauge transformation and I contract it in omega and I put the minus sign. So now we can compute minus. So with this notation that I choose, this is alpha. Again, omega is now a two-form in field space. I use this field space contraction, meaning that I take this parameter alpha, but I view this really as a vector field on the space of fields. And I contract this in here. And we get, so you keeping track of the minus sign, we get delta star F. Which is minus delta alpha star F wedge delta A. But now delta alpha acting on star F that's zero, because F is gauge invariant. So I only have one piece left, is this delta star F. And delta alpha on A, that's the U1 gauge transformation, d alpha, wedge d alpha. So now two important things to observe. The first thing is that in this case, this is delta exact. It's delta exact because the only field now contribution in here is star F. And here I just have D of alpha. This does not depend on the fields, right? So I can pull the delta outside. And this is really delta of the whole thing. Star F wedge D alpha. So this is indeed delta G alpha. And now you see why this is very nice. The very nice thing about this formalism, which was not obvious from, I mean, it is a bit obvious from here, but a bit we have to think about it to notice, but here it's completely obvious, is that when you do this procedure, indeed, is what we said, this machinery is just a mathematical machinery, which you give it the gauge transformation, it tries to spit out a generator. But at least you know if the generator actually exists or if it's not delta exact. And if it exists, you see the form in which you get the generator. It's very convenient because the form in which you actually get the generator is already taking care of what we discussed yesterday, namely this subtle issue about the boundary terms and about the fact that what you think is the gauge generator, namely the constraint, maybe is not the gauge generator. You have to remove the boundary term. So you have to integrate it by parts. It's exactly what's happening here, in fact. You see, this is telling us that the generator is G alpha. Which is G alpha. But now, very conveniently, this is the generator which is functionally differentiable. Right? In fact, a bit by construction, because it comes from here. If you're lucky enough that this thing is delta exact, you see, you just go a step before. This expression makes it explicit that the object is functionally differentiable, because the variations delta p and delta q, they already sit alone here. So this is already giving you, by construction, the generator in a functionally differentiable form, which is what we did by hand yesterday, right? Yesterday, by hand, we said, oh, you start from the Gauss constraint, the Gauss. So yesterday we called it, this we called it G tilde yesterday, and right. This is the object we called G tilde yesterday. Yeah, yesterday we started from this, right? So in forms, this would be alpha. D star F, right? This. Integrated by parts. So this was the generator of this was the Gauss constraint identified from the Hamiltonian. But starting from this yesterday, we said, wait a minute, this is not a good generator of the gauge transformation because it's not functionally differentiable. If I take delta of this, I have to integrate by parts and I produce a boundary term. And what we did yesterday was to redefine this and to subtract the boundary term. In fact, I wrote the formula yesterday with the boundary term subtracted, but then Aldo pointed out to me that I didn't actually recombine the terms to write it like this, in fact. Right? This is just this integrated by parts, and you drop the boundary term. So that's the one which is differentiable. So this is that's the guy which is differentiable. So that's the genuine, true generator of the U1 gauge transformations. And the nice thing about this formalism is that it gives you already the correct generator. So the guy which is, in this case, functionally differentiable. And now, of course, you can now ask what happens if you have the Noether theorem in mind and ask what happens to this object if I go on shell. Well, if you go on shell, right, to go on shell, you have to reintegrate this by parts, right? Imagine I reintegrate this by parts. Now I go back to this plus a boundary term. And on shell, I'm left with the boundary term. So I'm left again. This is already consistently telling me that the generator of the gauge transformation on shell is not zero. It's a boundary term. Right? So if we rewrite G alpha again in this form, D star F alpha plus alpha star F, then on shell, you're left with the boundary term. left with this. And this is, we recover immediately all the structure which we mentioned yesterday. Yesterday, it took us a long time to realize that, well, if you're in Hamiltonian form, gauge transformations are generated by first-class constraints. But then if you do this for Maxwell, the first-class constraint is the Gauss constraint. But it, there seems to be a problem because it's not functionally differentiable. So to make it functionally differentiable, you subtract the boundary term. And when you subtract the boundary term, in fact, what you end up considering is this. And this thing now is what we also said yesterday. That's the true good generator of the gauge transformation, but on shell it's not equal to zero. On shell it's equal to a surface term. Okay. So you see that this formalism is nice because it gives us it kind of gives us very nicely access to this structure. In the notes, I put the example of Yang-Mills, in fact. So same as this, but for Yang-Mills. So everywhere you have covariant derivatives, but it's the same structure. And now I wanted to mention, there's only 3 minutes left, but I think there's something important to, 2 minutes left, but I just write one formula and explain why it's nice and why it's very important. Because in fact, many people, and I mean, I'm interested in gravity and also many people here, and Aldo and many other people at PI. And so this is used a lot with in mind applications to gravity, in fact. So in gravity, what can we, I also just want to show why this is very important for gravity, because it gives some structure which we have not seen for the moment. There is yet some non-trivial structure to understand, and we can get this structure by, again, manipulating a bit these objects which are here. So if you allow me to go maybe 5 minutes over time, I write a formula for in the case of gravity. So the first thing is that for gravity, the first thing we have is that, again, the gauge transformations, they are Lie derivatives. And they act on the Lagrangian by giving this, right? Xi contracted with the Lagrangian. That's the differential form version of the formula we had earlier. Earlier, we wrote everything in, not with forms, but with explicit components. That's the action of the Lie derivative. By the way, this just comes from the Cartan formula, right? The Cartan formula is that you act with the Lie derivative on any differential form. This is Xi contracted with the exterior derivative of the object plus exterior derivative of Xi contracted with the object in question. That's the Cartan formula for the Lie derivative acting on differential forms. So if you just apply this to the Lagrangian, remember that the Lagrangian is a top form. In four dimensions, it's a four form. So D of a four form is zero. You're left with this term. So you're left with this. So that's how the Lagrangian transforms. Okay, so to get this formula, so there's just one formula I want to derive and explain why it's very nice, what it tells us. So we start from the Noether current. So the Noether current, we said, so now again, we're using forms, so all the space-time indices have disappeared, right? I view the Noether current now as a three form, so there is no vector index. So the Noether current is, well, we know it's theta evaluated on the Lie derivative minus this boundary term, psi L, right? That's exactly the Noether current we evaluated earlier, right? Earlier when we showed that the Noether current is C plus divergence of Q, where C is zero on shell and Q is the Komar charge, this came from here, right? It's the same starting point written in form language. Now the only thing to do now is to compute the variation of the Noether current. What happens if we compute the variation? So variation of the Noether current, here I put variation of theta. And here again, I just have to decide whether the diffeomorphism parameter depends on the fields or not. Let's say that psi does not depend on the fields. So delta goes through the vector field and just hits the Lagrangian. Okay, so we just get this. That's just the variation of the Noether current. So now let's rewrite this a little bit. The first term I don't touch. Now the second term, this is psi contracted with. Now we remember that the variation of the Lagrangian, we go back to the very first formula we wrote. The variation of the Lagrangian is the equation of motion plus d of the potential. That's the variation of the Lagrangian that I put here. Okay? So I write the first term that doesn't change. I don't touch it. Now I just expand this. So there is psi contracted with equations of motion delta phi. In the end, we will go on shell. So we let's not, this will drop, we'll go on shell. Well, let me, if you want, let me go immediately on shell. Right? We don't want to carry a term. Let's go immediately on shell. Okay, so this is zero on shell. So we just have this piece, psi contracted with d theta. Psi contracted with d theta. But now what the trick is to actually recognize that this, psi contracted with d theta, up to a term is the Lie derivative of theta because of the Cartan formula. Right? What we have here is psi contracted with d theta. So up to this piece, it's the Lie derivative of theta. So let's just write, use this, delta theta, delta psi. So I write the Lie derivative of theta plus this piece, this compensating piece here. So plus d of psi contracted with theta. Okay. And now we're almost done because here we recognize. Now we should just recognize that the first term here, so again using the language, the notations that we had before, this is precisely minus the contraction of the vector field of the Lie derivative with the symplectic current with little omega, right? Because remember little omega is delta of theta. Yeah, so why is that the case? Well, it's the case because we go back to these notations and rules that we had. Omega is delta theta. So if I take a vector field psi and contract it in omega, again, I'm not contracting a vector field with a differential form in space-time. I'm contracting this thing as a Lie derivative, as a variation in field space, with the field space variations which are in here. I'm not doing anything to space-time here. I'm doing something to the field space properties of this object. Well, this, again, using the rules that we had written earlier, so the contraction of a tangent vector on field space with a differential form on field space, this is the Lie derivative acting on theta. Again, I should remember that here, this is really, right, there are two variations here. There is one which is in front, and there is already a variation in theta. So when I contract this with this, which is a two-form in field space, I have to contract with this entry and then with this entry and anti-symmetrize. So first, I contract with this entry, so I have the Lie derivative of theta. I still have a delta hanging inside here. And then minus, this delta stays here, and now I have theta evaluated on the Lie derivative. So this is exactly what's here, right? So that this is why the piece which is here, the first piece up to a minus sign, this is indeed minus the contraction of the Lie derivative with omega plus psi theta. In fact, I should tell you where we're going with this. Where we're going is that we want a general expression for the generator of the diffeomorphisms. Earlier, we used this machinery to ask in Maxwell theory, if I know omega, what is the generator of a gauge transformation? So we took omega, we did this contraction, this gave us the generator. Here I want to do the same thing. I want to know the, I know the symplectic structure, a little omega. I'm not integrating this on sigma, so I have little omega, right, instead of capital omega, because I don't have integrals yet. The generator is here, according to the prescription we had earlier. That's the, that should be the generator of the diffeomorphism. So we're trying to find the general formula for this object. We can get this because we also remember that J is C plus DQ, right? Remember that in the first place, the Noether current is this. And on shell is just DQ. That's the first and the second theorem. Again, that's the structure that we argued for yesterday, that we tested before on Maxwell and on gravity. The Noether current has this form. There's this piece which vanishes on shell, and then DQ. Again, the same formula as before, but written in differential forms here. So J is a three form, it's DQ, Q is a two form. Q is the Noether walled surface charge. It's a two form. So now I just use this, the fact that J is on shell is DQ. So this thing on shell is D delta Q. And now we get to the result. The result is that minus xi, maybe I integrate it. The result is that minus xi contracted with omega. Now I integrate this over a three-dimensional hypersurface. And you see, but the only thing that's left are surface terms, because this is related now to D of something, of a two form, and D of a two form. So everything I'm left with is as we expect, right? We expect that all the generators are surface terms. Well, we're left with a surface term. We're left with the integral over the boundary of delta Q minus psi contracted with theta. And that's the formula, in fact. That's the formula we wanted. So first thing, let's just agree that structurally we didn't make any mistake, that it's correct, right? Again, omega is a two form in field space. There's two variations inside. Here I'm using this field space contraction, this double hook like this, to contract with a gauge transformation. So what this should return is a one form in field space. I'm lowering the form degree from two to one. So on the right, I should have a one form in field space. That's the case because here there is a variation of Q. Q is just the Noether walled charge. There is no variation in Q. There is no variation here. But here I have delta Q, so that's good. I have a one form in field space. Q is a two form, it's integrated over a 2D surface, it's all good. And here, it's correct. Notice that here, this contraction here is in space-time now. This is a regular hook. It's not a hook in field space, right? So this is really Xi seen as a vector field, just a regular, good old regular vector field, contracted with a differential form. And theta is a three form in space-time. So I contract a vector field with a three form, I get a two form, so everything is good. So two form integrated on S. And there's still a delta in theta. There is still a delta hanging in here. That's good because this should be a one form in field space. So here there is a delta, there is a delta, there is a delta in here. But this, so now two things to be said about this formula. This formula is very interesting because it shows you, first of all, that this is not delta exact. It's not delta exact. It's not delta exact. Well, because if you remember the form of theta, we wrote theta earlier, the symplectic potential for gravity. Well, theta has a bunch of variations of the metric inside, and it's clearly theta is not the delta exact. It's not the total variation of something. So this term is not delta exact. So because of this, it's kind of manifest that this generator is not actually delta exact. And the other thing which is important is that you see that this, from this point of view, the lesson is that if you use this covariant phase space formalism to build this object, then ask the question, what is the generator of the diffeomorphism with parameter xi? You get that, in fact, the Hamiltonian generator of the diffeomorphism is not only given by the Noether charge, which is this piece q. This piece q is well behaved. You get the variation of the Noether charge. If we just had this, it would be, everything would be fine and satisfactory in a sense. In fact, it's not the case. This formula shows that, in fact, the good generator is not, I shouldn't call it generator because it's not delta exact, but the object returned by this has a delta exact piece given by the Noether charge, plus a piece which is not delta exact, which is this one. And there's several things to say about this piece here, this quantity which is here. The first thing is that, you see, because of the structure of this, this piece is actually vanishing if this vector field is actually tangent to the surface. So if you want this problem, the fact that the charge appears to be not integrable, not delta exact, is due to the fact that I have considered a completely arbitrary diffeomorphism here. And a completely arbitrary diffeomorphism can move the surface here in arbitrary, any of the arbitrary four dimensions. So in time, in the radial direction, or along this surface here. And maybe it's not obvious from this structure here, but in fact, the statement is that if xi is actually tangential to this surface here, this piece is vanishing. Should I conclude or? Yeah, so I make one last comment. We can discuss more about why this has this structure. A final comment about why this is completely consistent with what we said a bit briefly yesterday about energy and all these things. So the question is, why is this compatible with, for example, if you want to compute the energy, for example? And it's actually a beautiful compatibility. The fact is the following. Yesterday we mentioned that we talked about this Komar energy. We took this Komar integral yesterday, which was minus C4, 8 pi g, integral of d2x, mu nu, nabla mu xi nu. We took this yesterday. And we said, oh, it's very nice because if you take this, in fact, we chose a bit this by hand. I didn't tell you why we chose this. In fact, we chose this such that, like yesterday, when you evaluate this, for example, on the Schwarzschild solution for the time translation vector field, you get the mass. So this gives you, in particular, the mass. And that's nice. That's, in fact, why you have this normalization here. But what we didn't say is that if you apply this formula, for example, in the Kerr spacetime for the angular momentum, for the vector field corresponding to angular motion, in fact, you don't get, as you expect, the angular momentum. You get actually twice the angular momentum. And clearly, you cannot fix this without messing up. I mean, it's either you get the mass right or you get the angular momentum right. You cannot mess with the normalization factor here. So in fact, in the literature, at some point, people were kind of, there's papers that mention this factor of two problem in the Komar charge. In fact, this is completely resolved by this quantity, which is here. In fact, in a sense, if you want, this thing here, this piece here, we didn't keep track of the normalization here because I normalized Einstein-Hilbert with one. If you keep track of the normalization here, here you have minus C4 over 16 pi j. So you have this divided by 2. So if you apply this to angular momentum, if you want to compute angular momentum, for angular momentum, the vector field in which you're interested is tangent to the boundary on which you compute this. So this piece drops. This piece drops, and this, because now there is this factor 1/2, what was before 2j becomes j. You get the angular momentum. Now from here is what we said, if you get the angular momentum right, you get the mass wrong. So here you get the momentum right. And why you get the mass right also? Because you have, if you compute the mass, now this piece will contribute. It's a piece which we could not see before. We didn't have enough structure before to understand that this piece has to be here. And if you compute this, again, for Schwarzschild spacetime, you evaluate this on asymptotic time translations, you will find that this term also contributes. And this contributes in such a way that you get, at the end of the day, the mass also. So that's why this, that's one kind of use, one application of this formula. And it explains why this piece here is very important. and why it's not, in fact, just the Noether charge which gives you important physical information, but there is also potentially this piece which is here. But in general, if this piece is here, again, this thing is not integrable, and that's a bit, many of the modern current research is how to actually understand the fact that this generator is not integrable, how to deal with that. And okay, maybe, sorry, I went.
Thank you, Mark. So I just want to remind you that there is one another lecture this morning, but also Mark's tutorial this afternoon. So you can also catch him and ask more about this later. But if there are a couple of quick questions, we can go through them in a couple of minutes so that we still have a 15 minute.
That's not even a question. Just add
a hat
on because the last equality
is
very
long. Yes. Sorry that I killed the coffee break.
Chris,
yes.
Quickly and.
So this capital omega that we defined as, I guess, a two-form in field space, and thing that it defines like our symplectic structure. So that's like a symplectic structure on field space that is, I guess, in parallel or somehow compatible with a symplectic structure on like the differential forms. Or yeah, what is like the relationship between capital omega and then like some other differential symplectic form?
I mean that's the usual symplectic form you're used to. In fact, that's the.
But instead of a two form in space time, it's a two form in field space. This capital omega. Okay.
Yeah, right. But that's just because we kept track of this field variations which were here. Right. But this is not. I mean, this gives you the. If you did that for mechanics, you would get the standard, that's just the delta P, delta Q, right? That just gives you the, it's not some, how to say, it's not something auxiliary or different from.
Maybe a word to try to bridge. In mechanics, if you, write mechanics in this language, you write it as a one-dimensional field theory where time is the only space-time direction. Q and P's are field space direction, except that now they're on a finite dimensional target space, infinite dimensional one. And so these delta P, delta Q are two forms in target space. Here is field spacing. So there are a symplectic structure in exact. OK, then let's thank Mark again.